Lecture 34, The Federalist Papers and the Great Experiment.
William Gladstone, who between 1868 and 1894 served on and off as Britain's Prime Minister, declared the Constitution of the United States to be, quote, the most wonderful work ever struck off at a given time by the brain and purpose of man, close quote. But struck off is a misleading depiction of what was involved in completing this most wonderful work. Between May and September of 1787, a group of men convened in the State House in hot and humid Philadelphia. They took rented rooms, unless, as was the case for a few of them, they could make their way to their homes on weekends. They lived out of suitcases and spent most of their waking hours in tireless and often tiresome debate, made all the more difficult by the suspicions mounting among their countrymen. Their deliberations were, by their own vote, conducted in secret. The press was not invited. And if they were there for the express purpose of creating a nation, this was a purpose many reached with a reluctance bordering on outright refusal. Rhode Island didn't even send delegates. The measure that created the convention had been adopted the previous fall at the Annapolis Convention. There, commissioners from New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, and Virginia acknowledged the, quote, important defects in the system of the federal government, close quote, and they proposed what they called a convention of deputies from the United States to assemble, quote, for the special and sole purpose of digesting a plan for supplying such defects as may be discovered to exist, close quote. Annapolis had set no limit on the number of deputies. In the end, the states named 55 delegates. Interestingly, 25 of them had no formal college education of any sort, including Benjamin Franklin and George Washington. The other 30 had earned degrees from Princeton, 9 degrees from there, 5 from William and Mary, same number from Yale, a few from Columbia, and one each from Glasgow and from Oxford. It's clear from the notes so carefully taken by James Madison that the quality of discourse, however, reveals no difference between those with degrees and those with comparably sharp and sharply formed intelligence. If there was one delegate who knew all along that it was a nation that had to be created in Philadelphia, it was Alexander Hamilton. He had a plan. He even presented it, but it was extreme. A president for life with total veto power over all legislative enactments. Hamilton, it should be noted, thought that the greatest man who ever lived was Julius Caesar. But Hamilton also contributed among the most incisive, informed, and prescient ideas produced by this extraordinary assembly, and then later and especially in the Federalist Papers. It has sometimes been said that what took place during those 4.5 months was nothing less than miraculous. In fact, Jefferson, who wasn't there and who later would find out everything you could possibly want to know about those deliberations by reading the notes taken by Madison, couldn't believe that Madison was at once a full-fledged participant every day of the meetings, and at the same time could record these notes with such accuracy and completeness, dispassion, representing views contrary to his own with faithfulness and respect. Jefferson thought Madison's notes were miraculous, let alone what actually was achieved in the deliberations. Was this a meeting of wise old heads? Well, there was only one old head in the room. It was Ben Franklin's. Actually, this was more a young man's achievement, or at least the achievement of a vigorous assortment ranging in age from Jonathan Dayton, who was 26, to Ben Franklin, who was 81. The average age was 42, and this would have dropped perhaps into the high 30s if Franklin and the next two oldest had been removed. The meetings were presided over by George Washington, who was already a national icon. He speaks rarely during the 4.5 months, but his presence confers a nobility on the chamber. He occasionally reminds those assembled that these are, as it were, in-camera sessions. There's nothing to be said to the press. The press commenting on day-to-day affairs of this deliberative body could only drive the country to fearfulness and confusion. Well, how scrupulously was this principle adhered to? Quite scrupulously. There's one event that says much. Apparently, after one of the day's deliberations, someone of the representatives had his notes for the day fall to the ground, so they were on the floor of the room, and apparently another one of the delegates, seeing them on the floor and not knowing whose notes they were, picked them up and put them on the president's desk, on George Washington's desk. Next day, Washington holds up the notes, cautions people about the need to preserve confidentiality, and it's a measure of the esteem in which Washington was held by his contemporaries that no one claimed the notes. I mean, no one wanted to go up front and say, oh, sorry, George, these are mine. We know when Mrs. Adams will write back from the court of St. James what the estimation of Washington was even outside the continental United States. She tells us that with all the European dignitaries coming to the court of St. James, the one person who, when he entered the room, was obviously the aristocrat in the group, all eyes turned to him, was Washington. Now, because we've so mythologized Washington and because we're skeptical about our own mythologies, there's a tendency to underestimate the significance of this man in the forging of the American Republic. We all have our historical villains and favorites. I should think that if I were ever to presume to examine the cultural history of America at the founding, Washington would be the central figure, the embodiment of what, at least at the level of rhetoric, was taken to be the animating principles of the new republic. His nightstand apparently not only had the good book on it, but also Addison's Cato. He very much looked forward to productions of Addison's Cato. During one of the winter campaigns, he actually had Addison's Cato staged for the troops. I don't know whether it was to provide them with a greater moral uplift or perhaps to provide himself with it. Washington had a temper and was known to use languages that went well beyond the king's English. But when stoic resolve and self-reliance were needed in uncommon measure, Washington was the man of the hour. It was proposed that his title, when we finally constituted ourselves, should be His Excellency, or King. Rejecting all this, he calmly informed his admirers that he had not made war on George III in order to become George I. Now, the document itself that came out of the 1787 deliberations seemed to be lacking in something. When the press got hold of the drafts and alerted the people to what was contained, much of the collective conscience was startled by the absence of a Bill of Rights. This was but one of the obstacles to ratification, and it would be removed by Madison's drafting of those first amendments to the document that still stand as the Bill of Rights. But the fate of the draft Constitution was in doubt. It wasn't clear at all that the arduous undertakings in Philadelphia would come to anything other than yet another pile of papers on how one day there might actually be the United States. Now, I should ask, what does all or any of this have to do with great ideas in philosophy? The Federalist Papers, which were put together by Madison and Hamilton and John Jay, designed chiefly to win New York over to the ratification of the Constitution, I submit, are one of the great contributions to political philosophy. If the work had come from a single hand, had it been presented as a philosophical treatise, I think it would have surely ranked with Aristotle's Politics. Some might actually have ranked it above Plato's Republic, if only on the grounds of its realistic and practical wisdom. But the contrary is the case, for the authors of The Federalist did not intend to philosophize, nor did they think their readers were especially interested in philosophy. In these respects, their efforts are closer to Aristotle's than to Plato's. But many will scruple over the mere mention of The Federalist in such lofty company. So such praise needs a vigorous defense. And mine begins with these facts. First, New York did ratify the Constitution, and the principled concerns, not to mention widespread fears, of the thinking classes were addressed with care and judgment. The sheer realism of these essays locates them higher on the scale of political science than any other set of essays or dialogues, in my estimation. As a second line of defense, I quote from the distinguished Cambridge historian William Brock, who has edited a recent edition of the Federalist Papers. Brock says, quote, "Building with other men's bricks did not mean that the Federalist, or the Constitution it expounded, lacked originality. Written constitutions and fundamental laws have always been viewed with suspicion, but every federal society has followed these American precedents." Close quote. When one contrasts the arguments developed by Madison and Hamilton, and to a lesser extent by John Jay, with the dominating political treatises of the time, and I mean with Locke or Montesquieu or Rousseau, the most obvious difference is that one set of arguments is actually the template for a national government. And as this is the main reason why the American experiment, so-called, has been repeated with frequency and success by a score of newer sovereign states over the past two centuries, is directly traceable to the fact that the Federalist accomplishes what it sets out to accomplish. Finally, the contributors to the Federalist were thoroughly well-read in political science and political philosophy, not to mention world history and law. So if they're not citing Plato and Aristotle, Rousseau and Locke, Montesquieu and Machiavelli, it's not because they're not aware of them. It's because they recognize their audience to be various, large, pluralistic, a community of persons whose support and allegiance will depend on the success of specific arguments confronting specific criticisms. There is simply no anticipation of this in the record of political philosophy. Perhaps another word or two should consider this matter of building with other men's bricks. Now, in the industry of thought, that, after all, is what the bricks are for. The informing question is just what one has built with bricks provided by others. Most of the delegates to the Constitutional Convention were widely read, whether formally educated or not. Locke, Hume, Montesquieu, and others were a staple, of course. But I think it's more than interesting to note that the first American edition of Locke's political treatises was 1773, and there wouldn't be another edition for 160 years. Surely many had read Hume. I think Hamilton probably read Hume a little more than some of the others, though it would be Hume's historical work that would have been of general interest in any case. But we speak here of a reading public, not just of delegates who were well-read, but a colonial world of surprisingly well-read citizens. When Edmund Burke addressed Parliament on the need for reconciliation with the colonies, he was eager to remind his parliamentary colleagues of what he had been told repeatedly by major booksellers in London, namely, they sell more books in the colonies than in England, and especially books dealing with law. So it is useful to keep in mind that the founders were setting out to constitute a government in the wake of a war of revolution which was still regarded by many as a treason. The founders and the Federalist offer the world the grounds of justification, and then the practical implementation of those very principles that were the grounds of justification. Well, the Federalist Papers. Between October of 1787 and April of 1788, 85 letters or essays were published in New York newspapers under the name Publius by the three authors of the Federalist. By March of 1788, interest in the essays was so great as to call for the separate publication of the first 36 of them under the heading The Federalist, by which they are known to this day. Of the authors, it was Hamilton who planned the project and contributed the largest share, followed closely by Madison. John Jay's contribution was slight in number of pages, but his contributions were important on the points he did address. As the other two delegates from New York opposed ratification, Hamilton, the ardent defender, hoped that these essays would win over New York. Hamilton was not, as the expression goes, a man of the people. He was chosen as a delegate to the convention through the influence of powerful financial interests in New York, and had himself proposed presidential powers in the Constitutional Convention that seemed to many nearly tyrannical. James Madison, more than any of the other delegates, earns the praise for giving Americans their Constitution. He pulled things together. He was there first with the most that was needed at the time. He's a signal figure in the history of American politics. If I may say, it strikes me as the height of political and historical ignorance that the United States does not celebrate a Madison Day as a national holiday. A Princeton graduate, Madison is the beneficiary of Princeton's new curriculum. Under the new leadership, the College of New Jersey is now under the intellectual and philosophical and moral direction of Scotland's John Witherspoon, a promulgator of Scottish common sense philosophy and tutor to five who will come to be delegates to the Constitutional Convention. Witherspoon himself would be a signer of both the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. Madison completed his degree requirements at Princeton and then stayed an additional year to study with Witherspoon. So the influence was considerable, and I refer here not to a set of mechanical interdependencies, but a broad liberal Enlightenment outlook rounded in a common sense philosophy that is naturalistic, scientific, progressive. All this and a wealth of actual political experience are what Madison brings to the Federalist Papers. Well, did we get a republic? What, after all, is a republic? Madison actually answers the question. He says that a political regime is a republic only when the government's power is derived entirely from the people. And he says when it is, quote, administered by persons holding their offices during pleasure for a limited period or during good behavior, close quote. Now, nothing in this is new or controversial. That is, the leader of a nation serves at someone else's pleasure. It's a term of service governed by a consideration of good behavior. You can have the head of state impeached, etc. There is a republic to the extent that government is self-government, that those who lead that form of government are chosen by the people, serve at their pleasure, required to uphold standards of conduct acceptable to those who are governed. Alas, Madison observes, the lesson of history is that the closer something comes to approximating that sense of a republic, the sooner it dies. The republics that seem to make it are what he refers to as a kind of puritanical republic. John Adams was very much behind that view of republics. On his account, only, quote, pure religion or austere morals, close quote, will be capable of holding a republican form of government together. Recall Adams's perplexity in a letter to Jefferson as he wonders in the matter of France how, quote, 20 million atheists can govern a country, close quote. These concerns are at the forefront, and Madison, in Federalist 10, will distinguish between pure democracies, subject to the very factionalism that leads to anarchy, and the right sort of republic. In the latter, power is delegated by the people, not, as it were, held and wielded by them. A republican system of this sort is, as he puts it, able to, quote, refine and enlarge public views by passing them through the medium of a chosen body of citizens whose wisdom may best discern the true interest of their country, close quote. Moreover, as a further safeguard, a critical number of representatives must be elected, for the smaller the number, the greater the opportunity for cabals. In the same way, the union of states is a better hedge against faction than individual states are. Indeed, against the council of the philosophers, Montesquieu in particular, such a government is not reserved to small and relatively unpopulous states, but may be ideal for large and expansive and expanding ones. Hamilton, in Federalist 9, actually discusses this notion of Montesquieu's, concluding that his positions in the end, quote, are the novel refinements of an erroneous theory, close quote. I want to pause here and say, Hamilton in this is reflecting this general suspicion toward theoretical ways of solving practical problems. The nearly paralyzing tension, of course, arises from the need for a central government able to secure the finances and the defenses of the nation and the jealously guarded freedoms of the individual states. What, after all, is the difference between paying taxes to the British and being taxed by a central government within the national boundaries? And why should citizens of the United States commit their destiny to a document that lacks even a Bill of Rights? Isn't one tyranny being replaced by another? In Federalist 12, Hamilton makes out a strong case for the centralization of revenue, noting that, quote, "From the want of the fostering influence of commerce, that monarch can boast but slender revenues, and use unable upon the strength of his own resources to sustain a long and continued war. In a word, it takes a nation to protect a nation." But why no Bill of Rights? First, there's a strong principled position that if you set forth in a Bill of Rights such rights as the people have, you're in the preposterous position of giving government the right to determine what our natural rights are. And since, for a self-governing people, rights are what the people declare them to be, no one needs a list. Why put in a document what the government will grant? For to enumerate what the government will grant is to limit the rights. But another part of the story is this. The point of the Constitution was to constitute a nation and to give it a centrality, but not a centrality that will trump the interests of separate states. So the structuring is such that there are certain rights reserved to the individual states and their people, and these can't be abridged by the central government. Now, why not a Bill of Rights that tells us the rights the individual has that cannot be abridged by his local government? Well, let me pause here to make this point a little clearer. You certainly have a very good reason to protect the individual against encroachments by a central government that might have tyrannical pretensions. But don't you also need to protect the individual against the encroachments of a tyrannical state? Why is there so little said about the limitations on the states? Well, this is something that had to be thought through by Madison, understanding that in the matter of not delineating the rights of states and the distinctive rights of their citizens, some explanation is called for. Well, it's best to specify the powers of the central government and then make clear that except for these, all the other powers are reserved to the states and the individual citizens. With a Bill of Rights in place, the Constitution secures for the individual citizen protection against abuses otherwise inflicted by a national government. What the national government cannot impose on the individual, the separate state governments probably cannot either, and in any case, the states just are the resident citizens. A citizen of Maryland has voluntarily entered into that association. He can pick up and move somewhere else, which would be quite different from picking up and moving out of the United States. So it's in Federalist 46 that Madison makes all this explicit. Quote, "The federal and state governments are in fact but different agents and trustees of the people, constituted with different powers, designed for different purposes. The adversaries of the Constitution seem to have lost sight of the people altogether, and to have viewed these different establishments not only as mutual rivals and enemies, but as uncontrolled by any common superior. They must be told that the ultimate authority resides in the people alone, and that it will not depend merely on the comparative ambition or address of the different governments." We the people. Ah, the people. But what sort of people is envisaged by Madison? Montesquieu taught that there are three essential forms of government, each of which calls for the shaping of a distinct characteristic in those governed. Under a despotism, it is necessary to cultivate in the people, according to Montesquieu, the character or disposition of fear. Under monarchies, the required disposition is that of honor. But with a republican form of government, Montesquieu says, what is called for is nothing less than the cultivation of virtue. Now, we find this in the Stoic outlook of George Washington and many other founders, this recognition that a republic will succeed because we have the resources to create and preserve lives of virtue and self-sacrifice. A special kind of person is needed. Some of our people were referring to us as having natural kings and queens, natural aristocrats, not aristocratic by birth, but aristocratic by character. Madison, in Federalist 63, leaves the realms of theory and speculation to the Montesquieus of the world and draws the reader's attention to actual history, the actual history of failed republics. He discusses Greece and Rome, the peculiarities of their senates and the lifetime appointments, the tendency of citizens to misplace their true interests under the enthusiasms of the moment. He puts the matter quite cogently. This is Madison now. Quote, "As the cool and deliberate sense of the community ought in all governments, and actually will in all free governments, ultimately prevail over the views of its rulers, so there are particular moments, in public affairs, when the people, stimulated by some irregular passion, or some illicit advantage, or misled by the artful misrepresentations of interested men, may call for measures which they themselves will afterwards be the most ready to lament and condemn." Close quote. Madison knows human nature to be protean, sometimes fickle, gullible, occasionally foolish. The right form of government cannot rid human nature of its defects, but it can control them long enough for persons to engage in what finally is the lifelong mission of self-correction. There's something very powerful in the Federalist Papers as you read the separate contributions of Jay, Hamilton, and Madison, and that's the utter respect they have for the people whose allegiance they seek to cultivate. As with the philosophes and the secularization of knowledge, I would say what the Federalist Papers achieve is philosophy with a civic face. These are essays that require the citizen to take himself and his mission seriously, to recognize that all passion spent, self-governance is a risky business in which power without virtue is a sure path to a life without a point. Now, it's proper at this stage, the Federalist Papers having been reviewed and the Constitution that those Federalist Papers were designed to have ratified, considered on the whole a great work, to ask, in fact, whether the entities Madison had in mind as suitable for government of this kind still exist. Do you really have to be a certain kind of person? What sort of virtue is necessary in a republic of the sort the Constitution brought about? Whatever differences there were among the founders, there was one thing that united them all. This sort of experiment in self-governance presupposes an instructed population, products of a good education with a point, and the point being the development of citizens, the use of the resources of the community for the express purpose of creating that most unique of human entities, the citizen, the responsible, informed, inner-directed, virtuous person. This is quite different from one trailing degrees, having PhDs, enjoying expertise, great celebrity, being able to act in movies, etc., etc. No, it's a matter of character. And the view was that that character is forged chiefly by observing good examples and through education. Jefferson thought public education was the absolute foundation of this. So the answer to the question, what kind of creature is right for self-government, is one that a worthy government works to create. One doesn't come out of the womb with the status of a virtuous citizen. As Aristotle taught, it's a lifelong labor. The authors of the Federalist Papers knew that. Most of the 55 sent to Philadelphia knew that. Alas, we all know that.